I'd like to introduce Bhakti Vigan Swami Maharaj, a GBCN leader in the Eastern Bloc countries. I don't want to say Russia, it's much more than Russia, isn't it, Maharaj?
Yeah, it's a little more than Russia.
Well, he's here to talk about the bombing in Chechnya and other techniques for avoiding such things in this material world.
The 15th verse of the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Svayameva atmanatmana
vetatvam
purushottama
bhutabhavanabhutesha
devadeva jagatpate. Translation. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency, or Supreme Person, origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Lord Krishna can be known by persons who are in a relationship with Him through the discharge of devotional service, like Arjuna and his followers. Persons of demonic or atheistic mentality cannot know Krishna. Mental speculation that leads one away from the Supreme Lord is a serious sin. And one who does not know Krishna should not try to comment on Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is the statement of Krishna. And since it is the science of Krishna, it should be understood from Krishna as Arjuna understood it. It should not be received from atheistic persons. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, Vadanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajjnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdyate. The Supreme Truth is realized in three aspects, as impersonal Brahman, localized Paramatma, and at last as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So at the last stage of understanding the Absolute Truth, one comes to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A common man, or even a liberated man, who has realized impersonal Brahman or localized Paramatma may not understand God's personality. Such men, therefore, may endeavor to understand the Supreme Person from these verses of Bhagavad Gita, which are being spoken by this person, Krishna. Sometimes the impersonalists accept Krishna as Bhagavan, or they accept his authority. Yet many liberated persons cannot understand Krishna as Purushottama, the Supreme Person. Therefore, Arjuna addresses him as Purushottama. Yet one still may not understand that Krishna is the father of all living entities. Therefore, Arjuna addresses him as Bhuta Bhavana. And if one comes to know him as the father of all living entities, still one may not know him as the Supreme Controller. Therefore, he is addressed here as Bhutesha, the Supreme Controller of everyone. And even if one knows Krishna as the Supreme Controller of all living entities, still, one may not know that he is the origin of all the demigods. Therefore, he is addressed here as Devadeva, the worshipable god of all demigods. And even if one knows him as the worshipable god of all demigods, one may not know that he is the supreme proprietor of everything. Therefore, he is addressed as Jagatpati. Thus, the truth about Krishna is established in this verse by the realization of Arjuna, and we should follow the footsteps of Arjuna to understand Krishna as he is. Again, this is the prayer of Arjuna, where Arjuna glorifies the Supreme Lord. Svayamevat manat manam vetatvam purushottama bhutabhavana bhutesha devadeva jagatpate. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency, O Supreme Person, origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe. I took this verse because in this purport, Prabhupada explains the difficulties of understanding that God is person. He explains very beautifully that the highest understanding or the highest conception of God is to understand that ultimately He is the person. But even though theoretically many people accept it, theoretically many people understand that God must be person, and that he is some kind of person. Still, to understand him as person is very difficult. And here, basically, Arjuna states that Svayam evatmanatmanam vetatvam purushottama. Nobody can understand you. Only you yourself can understand you. And then, after stating this, that nobody can understand you, only by your own energy somebody can know you, or you yourself only know you. And this is actually the topic of the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna explains to Arjuna that ultimately, to understand God, you have to get mercy of God. Because that's the nature of person. You cannot know the person by mechanical means. Person, by definition, is somebody. To understand him, you have to get his permission. Like, for example, if I want to understand what is in your heart, you know, there is a way to do it. You can just, you know, take a knife and open your chest and look inside your heart. Do I understand what is inside your heart? No. But at the same time, if you yourself want me to understand your heart, you will pour it out. You will say what is there in your heart. So, and basically, that's the problem with understanding that God is the person. And here Arjuna very clearly states, to understand how is God person, what it means that God is person, you have to get his mercy. You have to get his consent to this. He has to agree. You cannot really say, you know, okay, Krishna, from now on I want to know you. Here we are, you know, let's go. So, it is a science. And in the beginning of this chapter, Krishna says that you cannot understand me. Nobody can understand me. Demigods cannot understand me. All the hosts of demigods and demons, which are the first living beings in this universe, cannot understand the origin of all, because he was before them. If somebody is before you, you know, to understand him, you really have to have his permission to do this. And it's not so easy to understand, you know, if somebody was before you. In any case, Arjuna says here, and then Krishna says, Krishna explains the signs. Krishna explains that there is a way to understand me. Krishna, in Chaturshloki of Bhagavad Gita, and the very essence of Bhagavad Gita, very succinctly and very shortly explains that how to understand him. He says, first you have to accept that there is an origin of all. Krishna says, Aham sarvasya prabhavam matah sarvam pravartate. I am the source of all material and spiritual worlds. And then he says, those who know it, they are always in ecstasy. And they always want to talk about me, they always want to understand me. And then, tesham satata yuktanam dadami buddhi yogam tam nyanamam upayantite. They worship me with love. And because they worship me with love, I reveal myself. I reveal myself to them. So that's the way to understand. That Srila Prabhupada stresses this. And when Krishna said this to Arjuna, when he said that I am sitting in everyone's heart, and if I want, I can lighten the darkness which is there in the heart of every living being by lighting the torch of knowledge within everyone's heart, then Arjuna burst into prayers. And he started glorifying Krishna because he understood. At that moment he understood. That's it. You know, at that moment, the revelation came to his heart and he understood, this is Krishna, this is God. What I see in front of me is not just a human being. He is the source of everything. And because of this, being overwhelmed by this realization and understanding, he started praying to Krishna. He started glorifying him and he started saying that this param, Brahma Param Dama Pavitram Paramam Damam. He started glorifying Krishna. And here he says that the only way to understand you is through the mystical process of revelation. One way why we cannot understand God, why essential reason why we cannot understand God, especially why we cannot understand God as a person, is that because we don't really want to do. Because to understand God as person, it's kind of commitment already. It's much easier to have an impersonal understanding of God, because you can deal with kind of impersonal mechanism in an easier way. Because impersonal means you do something and there is a mechanism. Some people, many people accept that there is a higher power behind everything which we see. But most of the people's understanding is that it's kind of mechanical power. You do something good and this mechanical power gives something good in return to you. And you are happy. And you don't really care about God as a person. Because to accept that God is a person, you have to really, you know, live with this understanding. And that means that it's not that mechanical. It's much easier to live with God who is not a person. Because to live with somebody who is a person is a problem. Those who are married, they know this. To live with somebody who is a person is difficult. You know, to live with somebody who is not a person or with something which is not a person, it's easy, you know, because you have your way of doing things and everything else has to obey you. But if near to you lives somebody who has his way of doing things and you have your way of doing things, he has his desire and you have your desire, this is not so convenient because every now and then you have to adjust your desires. And basically, that's one of the main impediments for us to understand that God is a person, because if we understand that God is a person, we really have to kind of care about him, which we do not really want. Because it's kind of, you know, if God is somewhere there, you know, it's nice to have God, but if we don't like him, we just, you know, close the curtain, you know, and we have our way, you know. But to understand that somebody is a person, person means desires. And if we live with somebody who has desires, we have to care for his desires. And who wants it, you know? Nobody wants it. I don't want it. Nobody wants it. Everyone is concerned about his own desires. And therefore, one main problem for us to understand that God is a person, because if we state that God is a person, we really have to accept that he has some kind of, you know, say in our lives. And it's not that, you know, that mechanical. People who really, you know, relate with God as some supreme power, supreme supplier. Sometimes Prabhupada, he would say that religion means to understand that there is God and how to get something from God. That's basically, in common terms, what religion is. You know, basic understanding of God in common religions is that he is the order supplier. You have some desires and you write down to God, you know, I want this and this and this and this. You know, as if he doesn't know what you want. He knows. And usually when we pray to God, it's also, we don't really understand that he's a person. Like one Christian author, he said that usually prayer is a very tactful way of reminding absent-minded God what he forgot. You know, very reminding, here I am, my dear Lord, and I want this and this and this desires. Please be careful, you know, please try to fulfill all these desires. But actually, when we live with the person, it's not an issue to tell him about our desires. The real crux of the problem is to know what his desires are. If we want nice relationship, if we want to establish relationship, relationship is always two ways. And if we want to establish relationship, our first priority and first concern should be what is his desire, what does he want? And that's the difficulty. And that's exactly the difficulty with God, because not only he is the person, not only he has his desires, but he also has the ways to fulfill his desires without even asking us. And sometimes he imposes his desires upon us. Like, there is a little anecdote about one Muslim mullah. Somebody asked Muslim mullah, how can you prove the perfection of God's will, that God's will is perfect? He says, yeah, that's very easy. All the time which I remember you, his will is perfect, because all the time which I remember myself, only his will is being fulfilled. Because if it was not so, at least sometimes my will would be fulfilled, but it didn't happen. Therefore, his will is perfect. In other words, you know, if somebody has an understanding of God, he understands that something is going on in our lives and it's not really the way we want it. And here in this prayer of Arjuna, he actually tries to explain that to understand God is a person means to understand that he has control over our lives. And that's the difficult thing to swallow. Here Arjuna says, and Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport, that there are stages of understanding this. And basically to understand God as a person is to understand how much control he has over our lives. And Arjuna goes on to say, Bhuta Bhavana Bhutesha Deva Deva Jagat Pate. And Prabhupada explains that somebody can understand that God is Bhagavan, is a person. And it's rarely people understand this. Most people, even if they have some religious background, even if they have some religious understanding, they prefer to relate to God as some kind of power, which really we don't want to care about him so much. But then he says the first understanding of God as a person, he says Purushottama. Purushottama means the supreme person. And then he says, even if person understand that God is supreme person, then he may not understand that he is Buddha Bhavana, means the father of all living entities. You may understand that he is a big guy somewhere there. But you may not understand that you are related to him directly. And father of all living entities means he is my father too. It means I have to fulfill his orders, his will. And then he says, even if one understands that God is the supreme father of everyone, still he may not understand that he is Bhutesha, means he is the controller of everyone. Not only his father, because sometimes father, you know, he may not really be in control of your lives. And oftentimes, especially when we become teenagers, we say, you know, you go your way, I will go my way. You know, get out of here. At least this is what teenagers do in the West. Yeah. So even to accept that God is Father is not enough. Therefore Arjuna says, Bhutesha, and Srila Prabhupada says, this is the higher understanding of God. To understand that he is Bhuta Isha, the controller of everyone, means to understand more about God than just to understand that he is Father or even understand that he is the Supreme Person. And then he says, Deva Deva, which means that he is not only the controller of small living entities as we, but he is the controller of big living entities, demigods. He is the controller of the Lord of Death. He is the controller of Vayu. He is the controller of everyone else. And this is, again, even more difficult. Because we are, and that's another difficulty for us to understand that God is person, because we are rebellious living entities. And because we are rebellious, rebels, they don't want to accept authority. Teenagers usually rebels, and they go to father and they say, you know, I want to have my way, you know. I want to do as I want. And therefore they reject the authority, and basically therefore they forget about the father. They forget altogether about father. And the same thing happened to us. Because we're rebels, because we don't want to accept authority, and because this is the main reason of us being here. For us to come back, we have to accept the levels of authority of God, and the more deeply we understand his authority over our lives, the more closer we are in a sense. And therefore Prabhupada explains in this purport that there is a stages of understanding personality of Godhead. He says Purushottama, then Bhuta Bhavana, and then Bhutesha, then Deva Deva, and ultimately Jagatpate. He is the Lord of the whole universe. He is the one who controls everything. And, of course, this is not even the highest understanding. The highest understanding is even higher. And Arjuna doesn't go here that high. That the highest understanding is ultimately God is not only the controller, but he is also the lover of all living entities. That there is the highest power of God, which is yet not revealed in this verse. But in any case, the point of this verse, the real point, the main point of this verse is to understand that God is person means to understand that he is in control. And this is actually the way to remember about him. Because ultimately Krishna says that essence of Bhagavad Gita, essence of spiritual science, the culmination and the real success of spiritual science is when you can remember about God 24 hours a day. Man manabhava mad bhakto mam yajimam namaskuru. Then when you really can remember about Him, and what Arjuna is explaining here is that ultimately to remember God, you have to surrender to Him. Because now we don't remember about Him. Why? Because we remember about whom? About ourselves. Because we don't care about Him. Because we care about ourselves. And this is called pride. Pride means that we are self-centered. And when we are proud, really pride is the main impediment, main obstacle, main hindrance for us to remember about somebody else. When we are proud and when we are self-centered, we don't really care about anyone else. We just care about ourselves, and you know, we care about anyone else only as much as it's needed for us to be happy in this world. But what Krishna says, that if you really want to remember about Me, you have to surrender. The culmination of Bhagavad Gita is this verse, man manabhavam man bhaktomam yajimam namaskuru mamavaishasi satyam te pratijanis priyosime. But then Krishna goes little back and He says that the way to achieve this is that sarva dharman parityaja mamakam sharanam raja. You think about Me, you surrender to Me. You become humble, because sarva dharman parityaja means, as Prabhupada explains in Bhagavad Gita, that it means sharanagati. It means that I totally surrender my will to the Lord. He is my maintainer, He is my protector, He is my everything. And by taking this humble position, I am acquiring the highest treasure of life, the highest happiness of life, is to remember about God 24 hours a day. Before and until I do this, until I accept God's authority in a very clear terms, until I understand that I have to surrender my will, until I understand that I have to take His ways, I will not be able to remember about Him. It's actually if we look in the Gospels, this is also there. We know that Jesus Christ, when He went in seclusion before He was crucified, He was praying to God. And He knew that something wrong is going to happen with Him. Something really bad, you know. He knew, He felt it in His heart. He felt that He will be suffering like anything. And He started praying. And initially, His prayer was, please, don't give me these sufferings. I don't want this. I don't want this. But when His heart became purified through the process of praying, then He said, okay, I accept whatever You will do to me. Let Your will be over my will. I don't want it. Yes, I don't want to suffer. Who wants to suffer? You know, nobody wants to suffer. But the perfection of religion means you surrender to Lord. It means whatever You send to me, whatever You do with me, I accept. And I accept with grateful heart. Basically, to understand that God is a person means to say yes to God. Like this famous mantra, which impersonalists chant, this Om mantra. The literal meaning of Om means yes. When they, you know, when they sit there in a seclusion and they, you know, do some pranayama and they say Om. What they say? They say yes. And yes is very important. What it means, yes, it means we say yes to God. Before, we used to say no to God, you know, no. I don't want this, I don't want this, this is not good, this is wrong, and you are, you know, you're a wrong person, you're doing this to me. But to surrender means to say yes to God. It means we say, you know, whatever You will do with me, whatever will happen in my life, I will accept with grateful heart. And that's also the meaning of Hare Krishna mantra, when we say Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Basically, that's the prayer when we say, my dear Lord, You please do with me whatever You like. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, He says this in His Shikshastaka, Masli Shiva Padaratam Pinastuma, Madarshanam Armahatam Karotuva. Yathatatava vidadatu lampatomat prananathastu saevana para. Whatever you want to do with me, I will accept. If you want to, you know, if you want to disappear from my life, it's fine with me. I will live in separation with you. In this separation with you, my love will even become stronger. And that's difficult. Not everyone is ready. Sometimes, you know, people, especially the beginners on the spiritual path, they say, you know, where is God? You know, you get God here. I want to see him. But this is not love. Love means, if he wants to appear in front of me, fine. If he doesn't want to appear in front of me, I accept this as well. If he wants to crush me, I accept this. If he wants to, you know, to make me happy, I accept this as well. Because I'm not concerned about myself, I'm concerned about him. This is the highest, the pinnacle of religious understanding, which is not easy. But we only can understand that God is person if we have this attitude within our heart. And basically, the sadhana, the practice of bhakti, means to develop gradually this attitude within our heart, the attitude of surrender. From being rebels, from being rebellious persons, we have to soften our heart enough to really say yes to God, and it means to say yes to whatever is happening with me as well. And it means ultimately, even this simple act of surrender makes one happy. When we say this, you know, we immediately feel that, you know, from now on, I'm Lord's property. I belong to him. Whatever he wants with me to do with me, I will accept. And I will not keep, you know, bitterness in my heart. I will not keep grudges in my heart. I will not keep all this, you know, bad things in my heart. I let it go. There is no reason for me to be bitter. There is no reason for me to be, you know, all this kind of negative kind of things. You know, I'm surrendered to the Lord. I'm his and he's mine. This is even higher understanding. I'm his. And ultimately, when I develop this understanding that I belong to him, that as Rupa Goswami explains in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the next stage of understanding, he's mine. He belongs to me. God is only mine and nobody's else. You become really possessor of the Lord. And this is actually, this is the perfection of life, because if we have God, we have everything else. If we don't have him, we are beggars. We are poor people. We don't have anything else. So we want to have God ultimately. And for that, we have to say yes to him. It means to accept what he wants. And only do what he wants us to do, and don't do anything else. And of course, this is not easy. Like there was a story in Orissa, once there was a king. And this king, he announced that on such and such day, I will fulfill all the desires of my citizens. You come to me, and you ask whatever you want. And a big queue was there, big, big, huge queue, and everyone would come to the king and said, you know, I need husband. And king would say, you know, find husband for her. And somebody would say, I need some money. And king would say, you know, take the money. And then there was personal servant of him, and he didn't ask anything. And the king was giving and giving and giving and giving and giving. And then ultimately he saw this personal servant and he said, you didn't ask me anything. Why you didn't ask me anything? He said, because I have everything. He said, no, you have to ask. And then this personal servant, being very clever, he said, okay, my dear Lord, I have only one desire. I don't want to ask you anything. But you please come to my home. You know, I want and spend night at my home. Just please come there. And the king said, yes, of course, I will do this. I will come to your home on such and such date, and I will spend night there. So... And the king announced to his ministers, I'm going to home of such and such servant of mine on such and such date, and I will spend night there. So the ministers, they became really alarmed. So they made a big road to this little home of this, you know, guy, and they rebuilt it completely, and they built nice, you know, bedrooms for the king to spend night. And he got everything. And of course, the king came and spent the night, and everything else remained with the servant. But the point is that if you have the Lord, you have everything. And to have the Lord, basically, we have to surrender to Him. We have to give up this rebellious attitude which is there in the heart and accept that He has to say over our lives. You know, that, you know, we are not on our own. There is somebody whose will we have to take seriously. And basically, as Prabhupada explains in this purport, to understand His will, how we can understand His will? Just one way. We have to read what He says in Bhagavad Gita. And we have to follow what He says in Bhagavad Gita as it is, without trying to, you know, twist it in such a way that it would feed our purposes. So, and that's the main crux of the issue, the main method of understanding God. Just follow Him, just accept His authority. And that's the first step. And when we do this, the next step will go more or less naturally. Then we will actually develop this very personal feeling about the Lord. But not before we say very clearly that, yes, I accept whatever you do. Then only we will feel that there is a person which is behind us, which is actually watching us at every step, and following us at every step, and helping us at every step. So that's what it is. And surrender means this understanding that God is always there, and He always helps me. Like there is this beautiful, you know, story about one man who once had a dream. And in a dream, that was before his death. Usually before when somebody is about to die, he kind of remembers everything which happened in his life. So this man had a dream, and it was before his death. So in his dream, he saw his whole life, you know, from the very beginning through the very difficult things. And he saw that, you know, he saw it in a symbolical way, that, you know, he saw like steps, the footsteps. And he saw that actually when he was passing through difficult situations, that there are always two footsteps, two rows of footsteps. And he was in this dream, he was talking with God, you know, and he kind of understood that while walking through the life, he was not alone. God is always there. He's walking with us. But then somehow or other, he, you know, when the difficult part of his life would come, he would see that there is only one row of footsteps. And he started arguing with the Lord. How is that possible? When everything is good, I see your footsteps and my footsteps, and we are going together. But when something is bad, there is only one, you know, row of footsteps, it means that you leave me at this point. And the Lord answered him, you know, no, at this point I would take you on my hands and I would carry you through this. So the footsteps which you see is mine, not yours. So if you are surrendered, then you have this feeling that in any situation of life, Lord is there. He is there to protect you. He is there to help you. He is there to be with you. But this feeling only comes, and this understanding only comes when you say this yes, when you say that yes, you are Purushottama, yes, you are Bhuta Bhavana, yes, you are Bhutesha, yes, you are Devadeva, and yes, you are Jagatpate, yes, you are the controller, yes, you know what you are doing. And whatever is happening to me is not just an accident, it's a perfect plan by you for me. So I think I will finish now. Don't want to go too late. If somebody has some questions.
It seems to me Prabhupada explained that there are two ways for the jiva. One is to be controlled by Maya, and the other is to take shelter of the internal energy. Mm-hmm. So when have this understanding of taking shelter, so it's not like a fearful thing to obey the order of the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, because in any case we are surrendered. But in one case we are surrendered to the illusory energy, because we are marginal potency, we have to take shelter of either one energy or another energy. But we prefer to take shelter of inferior energy, because we are being superior energy, have this illusory understanding that if we take shelter of inferior energy, we are in control. Because it's inferior. You know, and we're superior, and we're kind of manipulating it and controlling it and trying to control. But in any case, we are taking shelter either in inferior energy, and inferior energy means full of fears, because this is unnatural situation for us. Or we're taking shelter of superior energy, and it means fearlessness. Yes. When we really feel that we took shelter of the Lord, actually this is what Jiva Goswami explains. He says that the first sign of faith, if somebody has Shraddha, faith in his heart, the first sign, and this is how you can recognize whether you're a faithless person or faithful person, is that you become free from fear. When you acquire faith in God, an immediate psychological effect of this is you become totally free, or to a certain extent, to a greater extent, free from fear. And you see it, you can feel the difference in comparison. Yes, you're right. Thank you.
You were talking about how people who are impersonalists, they believe in karma, but they don't believe that God is personal. I was having a discussion with this one person who was a Buddhist, and they believe in karma. And that their understanding of karma is the same. If you do something good, you get something good. If you do something bad, you get a bad reaction. I tried to explain to him that proves that there's reciprocity. There's reciprocal behavior. Mm. Because if it's impersonal, then who decides what's good and what's bad?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get some person to understand that the law of karma is actually personal?
See, in a sense, law of karma is like law of the state. And behind the law of the state, there is a person. But law itself is impersonal. It's a mechanism to establish the will of the person, right? The president or the king of the state, he issues the law, and that's his will. But then with this will and with the law, he also establishes some mechanism to really fulfill the law. There is some kind of mechanism in place, and you don't really have to interact with him, and he doesn't have to interact with you. And that's basically what Krishna says at the end of the ninth chapter, where he explains this bhakti as the personal interaction. He says that there are, in reality, two kind of interaction between the human being and the Lord. He says, Samaham sarva bhuteshu na medveshti stina priyaha. He says, if somebody is, if somebody doesn't care about me, then Samaham sarva bhuteshu, I'm neutral. And I'm not really, actually that becomes the law of karma. Yes, behind this there is God, but it becomes law of karma. But then he says, but for my bhaktas, yabhajanti tumam bhaktiya, maite tesu chapyaham. If somebody worships me with love, that I take special care of him. So the law of karma is impersonal. The person is behind this. His will is fulfilled through the law of karma. But this is impersonal mechanism of the Lord. And it's there not without purpose, because it's specifically for those people who don't want to see God as a person. Therefore, he's kind of hiding. He's hiding away behind this law of karma. So if they don't want to understand this, they will never understand this. Because this is the purpose of law of karma. But if they have some brain, they can understand that law... Prabhupada explained it in a very simple terms. He says, if there is law, there must be somebody who established the law. There must be lawmaker, right? So that was simple reasoning of Prabhupada. And if they don't accept this, you know, what can you do? This is very logical understanding and logical answer to this question. But because they don't want to accept this, they will reject this understanding. And they will say, no, it's just impersonal. And basically Krishna says, yes, what can we do? You want me to be impersonal, so I will be impersonal for you. Yayatamam prapajante tapstatame bhajamyaham. I remember I came to United States in the year 2000, and there was a big meeting of religious leaders, some kind of interface meeting in United Nations, and everyone came. Muslims came, and Christians came, all different denominations, Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox, and Buddhists came, and some Hindus came, you know, and everyone, and rabbis came from Israel and from here, you know, different, you know, and everyone would have a chance to speak, and they would speak different things, and nobody would care about anyone else, and it was zoo. It was really, you know. So one journalist came to me, and was a Japanese journalist, and he wanted to take my interview, and he said, "What do you expect from this meeting?" And I'm being politically correct and polite. I didn't say that I don't expect anything good from this meeting, because these people, they don't really want to hear what everyone else speaks. So I had to say something. So I started, you know, feverishly think, what do I expect from this meeting? Because I really didn't expect anything. So I told him, yeah, perhaps we can expect that, you know, after speaking with each other and talking, you know, people can understand that there's only one God. And everyone is praying to one God, and everyone at least has this understanding in common that there is only one God. And then this, you know, Japanese journalist said, yeah, but I'm Buddhist, and according to Buddhist philosophy, there is no God at all. So even this is not the common ground, you know, among the different religions. And basically, as Krishna explains that, you know, Satvana Rupa Sarvasya Shradamayam Purushaha, that the your face, your conditioned face, Maya Shraddha, in 17th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Maya Shraddha is developed according to your to the condition of your heart. Sattva anurupa sarvasya shraddha mayayam purusho. One develops face according to his sattva, and sattva can be translated differently. Of course, sattva is sattva guna, and therefore Prabhupada there explains that face is coming from sattva guna. But another explanation, which is also given there in the purport to this verse, sattva anurupa. Sattva means being. Sattva means existence. So the face is coming, the conditioned face is coming from your existence or from your experience. In other words, you know, you live certain way of life, and this certain way of life develops or reinforces some face in your heart. And if you don't believe in God, you will have every possible proof that God doesn't exist. And Krishna himself says this. He says, if somebody believes in some demigod, I'm being in his heart, make his faith stronger. I give him all possible proofs that he is the Supreme Lord. So ultimately, if somebody doesn't want to understand that that behind the law of karma there is person, he has all facilities. Never understand this. But you can give him this simple argument that beyond any law, there is law making.
Maharaj?
Yes?
I was wondering, in Christian theology, there's really no idea of karma. I was wondering, what do you think that the story of Jesus' crucifixion has to say about karma within Christian theology?
Christian theology do have some understanding of karma, because they say, thou shall reap what you sow, something like this. They do have some understanding of karma. They may not understand and believe in the, you know, previous life and next life. And even this, they have some understanding. They say that there is future life. And of course, this is not very philosophical, and therefore, to explain out this whole tragedy which took place 2,000 years ago, they have to really they had to deify Jesus Christ. And their explanation of this whole thing is that he was crucified because he accepted the sins of all the people who surrendered to him at that time, and he will surrender to him, you know, for the eternity, more or less. So that's their understanding. And, you know, it's a little, to my taste, it's a forced understanding of this whole thing. But, you know, Christian people, when they were developing their theology, there was some understanding of karma and previous life and future lives, reincarnation. Socrates was speaking about this, but, you know, somehow or other it was developed in the way it was developed. Don't ask me why. To me, it doesn't make any sense. So, I never heard any good explanation from them. I spoke with quite big people on this very point. I asked the person, one theologian, Christian theologian, why somebody is born in a very nice family with all the riches, and he's beautiful and he's well educated, and why somebody else is born, if God is equal, God is fair, why somebody else is born in a very poor family, and his parents are drunkards, and he is, you know, diseased and has all kinds of problems, mental problems. And his only answer was, you don't know what is good for this person. And because God knows that this is good for this particular person, he gives him this. But, you know, this is very shallow explanation, because you have all rights to ask him. You know, I can understand this is mercy of God to everyone. That's fine with me. But if they don't have any previous karma, so to speak, why God creates somebody for whom good means to be born without legs, without hands, and you know, with the parents who are drunkards, and you know, and he's dull-headed, you know, why is it so good for him? And and again, the next argument would be, you know, how from experience we don't see how it is good. Some people do have some predisposition towards religion, and some people, they are born in such a horrible situation, they will never think about God. You know, they are so immersed in this material life that they will never... How is it good for them? Where is the proof that it is good for them? But they have no answer. They say this is, you know, they say this is all from devil. You know, that's something like this. And ultimately they will say, you are coming from devil, so you go to devil and I will follow my religion.
We were in New Vrindavan. Rana Swami explained how you came to Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to describe that?
He likes to tell the story. I told him this story. He forgot it a little bit. So he usually explains it not the way it was. In essence, it's this story. but this is part of the story. The part of the story goes like this, that which he explains, that I was doing my PhD degree in biochemistry, and at the same time I started associating with devotees, started chanting, and at that time everything was very closed, everything was very underground, and the KGB, the secret police, the secret intelligence of Russia was very active, and they were watching all the devotees. And they really started the whole huge campaign against devotees. And I was very new at that time. I was not really serious about Krishna consciousness. I was kind of trying. Somebody told me, you chant and your health will become better and something like this, you know, some kind of rubbish. I didn't really believe in God, but I had some understanding. Little understanding was there, but I was not really serious at all. So at one point, I came to my place of work where I was doing my thesis, I was making some experiments, and I had my chief, scientific chief, who was a very bold man. He was very, you know, very courageous man, and he was here in America, studied for some time, very famous too, very influential person. And when I came and I looked at him, I couldn't recognize him. He was white and he was trembling. He was coming from his office. And he looked at me and he kind of, you know, mumbled something. He said, "You go there." So I didn't know what to expect. So I went to his office and I saw a huge guy sitting there. And this guy was from the KGB. And he smiled very sweetly at me when he saw. I think that the, you know, the spider probably have the same smile when he sees the the little fly in the cobweb. So I was there face to face with him, huge guy, you know, a heavy guy. And the guy started, you know, he said, "Oh, you are such nice educated person, and you are, you know, I know you are speaking with this Hare Krishnas, you know, and that you are chanting Hare Krishna, and you know that they are very bad people." And he started, you know, saying all bad things about these people and, you know, flattering me, intimidating me, blackmailing me, saying so many things. And I became really afraid. And ultimately his point was, you have to work for us, you have to spy for us. You have to go to these people and, you know, report to us regularly what they're doing, because otherwise you will lose everything which you have. You will lose your career, you will lose your, you know, profession, you will, and we will make your life hell and we will put you in prison. Everything was said there. And I became really fearful. Because I was not really serious about Krishna consciousness. I was chanting a little bit. And so what happened next? And then he said to me, and I didn't give him definite answer. I definitely didn't want to say yes, but, you know, I was afraid to say no either. So then he said, "You come to me, to the headquarters of the KGB, on such and such day. And by that time, you have to think really seriously about this. And by that time, you will have to give me your definite answer." And the mind is such a guy, you know. The mind started really scaring me even more than this guy. Because he knew what he was doing. He just planted some seeds, and the mind was started projecting, you know, this is going to happen with you, and you will suffer in Siberia for the rest of your life, and what going to happen with this, you know. And I was becoming more and more worried. And then ultimately, before this date, on this day, before to go to them, I decided to meet with a devotee. I knew at that time a few devotees, and there was one girl there. She was probably 18 years old or something like this. Very intelligent, nice girl. And because I kind of developed some respect towards her, I wanted to speak with her. So I called her, and I said, I need to speak with you. And, you know, I had, you know, all the problems in my throat. You know, I could hardly pronounce words. And she came out and we met in some secret place or whatever. You know, and I said, "They came to me." And she already knew what it means, because at that time all the devotees knew what it means. "They" means KGB, you know. Who else could come to you? And also I said that, threatening me, this and that. And she just looked and she smiled. She said, "What can they do to you?" she said, you know, "What can they do to you?" And I, you know, she said it with such a conviction and such a face. And I said, "What can they do to me?" You know, I kind of came back to my senses. I'm spirit soul, I'm eternal. By that time, I kind of had this understanding. So I went to this guy after her, and I was really bold, you know, I was proud, you know, I had my, you know, and I marched in the room where he was sitting, and he was sitting with another guy, you know, and he again smiled at me, and I was, you know, so he asked me, "Did you decide?" I said, "Yes, I decided." "What did you decide?" I said, I will not work for you because this is against my principles. And I was very proud of pronouncing this in a very bold tone. And he became furious. Like I said, what kind of principles do you have except for four regulative? You know? Besides four regulative. And he started yelling and, you know, smashing me and... You know, but I again became very small. But then I kept my word. I said, no, I'm not going to work. And he said, you will see. So, and that went on. You know, they started calling me and interrogating me. And, you know, and every time I was, you know, kind of going to them. And every time Krishna, I felt the protection of Krishna. I felt some kind of very strong energy in my heart after all these things. And then gradually, what came to me that this understanding that these people really take Krishna consciousness so seriously. I don't take, the KGB, I don't take Krishna consciousness that seriously. They take it much seriously than me. And I thought for myself, maybe I should also become more serious about Krishna consciousness because the guys know what they're doing, you know. They are not stupid. They are not fools. They really know. If they take this movement so seriously, it must be real movement. It must be very, you know, powerful movement. So in a way, they kind of helped me to become more serious about Krishna consciousness. So that's a little story.
Therefore, some you had some devotee from, it's like KGB officer because he was studying for so long. Is it true? You had some devotee in the Moscow temple.
We probably have a few of them. No, I heard a story. It was not in Moscow temple that KGB sent one guy, planted one guy, spy in a temple. And the guy became a real humble guy, you know. And he started washing pots and started, you know, chanting mantra and everything, you know, singing kirtans. And he was, at the same time, he was working for the KGB, reporting to them, reporting. But ultimately he thought, what am I doing, you know? Everything which I heard makes sense. And he, you know, he gave up KGB and became the full-time devotee. That's also, the story was there. That happens. It actually happened to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, when he started preaching, the English authorities at that time became really alarmed because there was a big movement. And, you know, they were afraid of all this movement because at that time, you know, this nationalistic spirit in India was becoming stronger and stronger and stronger. So they sent one guy to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and said, you sit on all his lectures and see if he is trying to agitate people and trying to say something against English authorities. And this guy was sitting and listening to lectures of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and he listened and ultimately, he says, okay, I surrender, you know. And he became a sannyasi in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's movement in Gaudiya Math. So that association with devotees is very dangerous. It's dangerous. I think I should go. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.